chatting it up again with all of you in a brand new week, Monday, May the 6th, 2024, on Connecticut Today. We spoke with Fairfield GOP State Senate member Tony Wong from the Capitol as the current legislative session winds down. Connecticut News Junkie columnist and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill was back with us to voice his concerns about a possible weakening of the state's freedom of information laws. Republican State Senator Tony Wong is with us. Tony is up at the Capitol, dodging the bad stuff. Hopefully, Tony, you have your hip boots on to, wade away from the bad stuff there and keep us up to date. How are you?
I am great, and thanks for having the opportunity. And the implementer, which is in essence the budget.
Oh, here we go.
With the allocation of money and inclusion of many bad bills in a 350-page document, and we have a special name for those bad bills,
yes,
or special favors. We call them rats, and it's been a national pastime or a state pastime. Whenever anything that's a big budget item coming out, we look for the rats, and they certainly did not disappoint.
Okay, so Tony, explain to my listeners here, and I've explained this before, that oftentimes, Tony, you've told me this and other legislators, when a bill is said to be dead, it really isn't dead, and a lot of times it resurfaces as part of the budget implementer, which is basically the keys to the car. You've got to pass this bill to initiate the budget. So what is in there, Tony, that maybe shouldn't be?
Well, the problem is I haven't been able to read through all the fine prints, but let me give you a couple of nuggets of partisanship, mm-hmm. One of which was the governor in an agreement, I believe, because the governor was in the discussions with the Democratic Senate and House majority. No Republicans, I believe, were in those discussions. One of them was to set aside funds to be able to pay for striking
mm-hmm.
workers.
I just talked about that. Yep, yep.
It just seems, I've had conversations with labor advocates in this, and they explain that this is important to be able to help those men and women that are out on the picket lines, losing earnings. I totally understand and I respect the collective bargaining process. But as I said to the advocates, that is the risk and the exchange for collective bargaining, because when you go on strike, you withhold your services and you stop productivity and you hurt the employer that you're striking against. And that is the tug of war in regards to collective bargaining. What this is saying, using state taxpayer money to subsidize individuals that choose to go on strike, to kind of tip the balance of collective bargaining power to one end to say, hey, go on strike. We'll use state taxpayer money and make sure that you're made whole. That, to me, is really fundamentally an abuse of taxpayer money and an uneven tipping of the scale for striking workers. Make no mistake about it. There are times when striking workers have every right, what we've seen in the commercial food workers against Ahold, the Stop and Shop. They have every right to do that, and they have the full support of me in regards to the wage and work rules initiative. But this is one where you're tipping the scale using state taxpayer money, and that certainly did not go through the committee. As advantageous as the Democratic majority is, that wasn't even susceptible to the palate of people to vote for it. It's going to be stuck into this bill. There are many others. One of them is we're now using ARPA money to be able to address so many of the particular needs that have been asked. There was an instance where we have 250 or around that range of ARPA money that needs to be spent by mm-hmm. December 31st. Mm-hmm. Now, there were over 700 million, if not a billion, in nonprofits and community needs. And we are saying, look, ARPA money has a specific need. We have a spending cap that we need to live under. Well, that all went out the door. We are now using ARPA money to address some of those needs. Rightly, some of those organizations, many of those organizations are well-deserving, but many were left behind. So you're picking winners and losers on these nonprofits. Mm-hmm. But secondly, you're now going to bond some of the operating expenses into the credit card of the state, thereby usurping the spirit and the real guidelines of the vaulted guardrails and spending cap. So again, we're playing games in regards to trying to make a document in which we're trying to make everybody happy, but still say to the general public, we're living within our guidelines. And that, to me, is disingenuous.
Yeah, Tony Wong is the guest. Tony, something the House voted on unanimously Friday was the election reform bill, the ballot reform bill. Sailed through the House. I know the Republican caucus was okay with it. They wanted more. But a version in the Senate was kicked back and defeated by the Judiciary Committee. What is the status with that? And please tell me, we're going to do something with this in the next 2 days, because if nothing, Tony, substantive passes, I think you and I would agree that would be just unacceptable. But where does all that stand?
Well, I think the election laws have been a tremendous cause of disagreement between Democrats and Republicans. I think one of the themes that has been at the crux of it is, where do you penalize and enforce the law against those people that have been shown to have violated and besearch mm-hmm. our election laws? Unfortunately, it appears, frustratingly, that it's only a slap in the wrist. And that's frustrating. Although we may put up a lot of other election law and safeguards, here's the point. Mm-hmm. We can put all the laws we want, and we can say these are penalties in which people who violate and abuse and deny and erode the trust of people that they have in the electoral system. But when you don't slap penalties and when you don't punish the very people who perpetrate these kind of abuses of election laws that we try to implement, you're really missing the point. So that, to me, was a real crux of the frustration. We can pass all the laws we want, but if we're not going to punish people and make an example that this is unacceptable at any time in any election, then you know what? We're just empty promises on that. So
yeah.
That, to me, on election law has been a huge frustration. We can do all we want, and now we're going to do early voting and all the premises of access in voting. But nevertheless, if we catch people, and I think we have incidences of that on video camera, but if we catch people and you don't enforce the law, then why do we have it in the first place?
Yeah.
It's a false sense of security.
Yeah, Tony, I don't know whether anybody up there knows, and I'm just being tongue-in-cheek here, where they say, well, we're going to put cameras on the drop boxes. Well, Tony, people will watch for cameras. They'll wear hoodies. They'll wear masks. They'll park three blocks away from the box and walk. So, listen, a lot of people aren't the sharpest knives in the drawer, but at least they know how to get around those. But that's just me, Tony. Call me nuts.
Well, I think one of the things that I've always said, you know, election fraud has been used to be weaponized as a debate back and forth. To me, there are always inaccuracies, there are always malfeasance in their electoral process. Does it make enough difference to turn races on a national basis? I don't believe so. But that being said, any kind of evidence, any kind of document of malfeasance, you need to punish it.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then they're just empty promises and people will continue to abuse the system.
And finally, Tony, racial imbalance in some of the schools in your area and district, and also zoning. What is up with that? What happened? What may happen? What didn't happen? So wrap us up on that.
Absolutely. There is a significant bill advocated by Desegregate Connecticut. There are parts of it that I understand that would benefit economic development and some aspects in regards to transit-oriented development, and we're already seeing that. So, for example, Fairfield and Southport is a great example. We have a transit-oriented development initiative on the Black Rock train station area, and you can see that booming opportunity, and that works. But you have to be balanced between what we do in the downtown station, where there are residential as well as pre-existing commercial properties. This kind of bill, TOD, gives as of right. And what's the definition of a as of right? I've been using the word carte blanche, a blanket check that says any developer that goes within that circumference by this bill can build within their desire, without having to go to public hearings or to have the challenge of local zoning guidances. That, to me, is unacceptable. Now, we want to go to the other extreme. In Southport, Connecticut, which is a village with a train station, you have resident homes, you have bucolic communities. That bill, if applied, would impact the Southport community. And that, to me, takes the note of one size fits all, and it doesn't work in regards to transit-oriented development. The concept is sound, the idea is great, but it shouldn't be applied to every single town with a as-of-right approval. The positive thing is, Paul, we actually can do good things in Hartford, believe it or not. And one of the things that we did with the work of the Commissioner of Education, as well as leadership in the Education Committee, and also listening to our local Board of Education, one of the biggest issues is a long-standing regulation in the state of Connecticut to have a racial imbalance correction. I believe it's in the aftermath of Sheff versus Ferguson, and to be able to versus O'Neill, Sheff versus O'Neill, to be able to have racial imbalance corrected to give every child an opportunity and equity concerns. But what I've learned is the fact that it hasn't worked. And ultimately, when you look at the recent Supreme Court decision in regards to race not being a determining factor, or it can be a determining factor in regards to admissions and education, and also the Civil Rights Act that says race can never be a consideration in anything we do on public policy, we have taken the approach, thankfully, to be able to put a delay in this implementation that would have forced significant redistricting plans be put in place for kids and families in the Fairfield and Greenwich communities or any other community that's impacted by racial imbalance, that we're going to delay it for a year, do a study to find out how and the best possible way, based upon experiences and data, how we can enrich every child's opportunity to a great education. So this is one example where we did do some good things, and I'm encouraged about it. So we do some good things up here, Paul, believe it or not.
Excellent. Tony, keep me updated with that. Send me a text, give me a call, whenever. Tony Wong. Always good to hear from you, Tony. Fight the fight, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
And let's go Rangers.
Oh, yeah, baby. You got it. Thanks, Tony. I appreciate it. Tony Wong, he's got that right, baby. After a week back, he's off. Substack.com blogger and Connecticut News Junkie columnist Terry Cowgill, who can't wait to talk about various things in the news, including the hunting exploits of Christy Noem. Terry, how are you?
Hey, not bad. I'm getting over the jet lag from the Pacific Northwest, but I think I'm just to have my shot of B12, and I'm all hyped up and ready to go.
Excellent. You know, poor man's steroids right there. Absolutely. Got to do it. Hey, that was a staple with the New York Yankees in the 50s and 60s. You know that? They used to get B12 shots, like, on a regular basis. Really? Honestly.
Well, they say that President Biden takes a shot of B12 every now and then.
Trust me.
And Donald Trump apparently snorts Adderall.
So, yes.
You know, we all need our little stimulants every now and then.
The Adderall snorting, yeah, that's an image I could do without. Terry, on the list of stuff you on the list. Look, it was better last week. Listen, on the list of stuff you sent me, we'll get to the serious stuff at the end. But you can. The Christy Noem thing. I mean, my God, what is up with her? Yeah, I shot the dog. So what? Oh, God.
Well, there was the dog incident, and that's really just a question of whether or not you agree with that kind of approach to solving the problem of a troublesome animal that you own.
Yeah.
Now, frankly, I had to put down a dog once when I was early was a young adult. I took him to the vet and, put him to sleep.
Well, yeah.
I wouldn't think of taking a dog out to a gravel pit and taking a gun to its head. It just is bizarre that she wants to do that. But, you know, she said it. Apparently she thought that it would be to her advantage to write this in her book. But, you know, it just seems crazy to me. The difficult part, and I think the most troublesome part for her really, is this idea that she met with Kim Jong-un. And but, you know, she's basically admitting now that she didn't, although she won't say it. You saw that interview that Margaret Brennan did on Face the Nation with her?
Oh, yeah.
That was painful to watch. Really was.
Yeah. So, you know, Terry, you and I both know, covering people as we have for years, some people just live in an alternate reality and they get in too deep. And, you know, when I was young, I heard the phrase, stop digging. It's better to stop digging and say, hey, I screwed up. But
yeah.
I guess in her case, she still thinks. In fact, Terry, can I tell you this before we get to the serious stuff? I get emails from an offshore casino. Okay, that does betting. In other words, they do betting on U.S. politics, and it's fascinating. And I just got it here, and she is she's now 33-1. Just so you know, for your betting purposes of being the VP, mm-hmm. So she's dropped to 33-1. So there you go.
Well, the betting. Odds and I think are much better predictors than the polls. So mm-hmm. I think that's good. What I think really is that she didn't write the book because they.
Oh yeah.
You know, she said what happened here with Kim Jong-un? Did you meet with it or did you not?
Yeah.
And she danced around. Well, I'm not going to discuss private meetings with. Or once it was brought to my attention, oh. I had a change. You wrote the friggin' book.
I barely not
brought to your attention. That makes it sound like there was a ghostwriter.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody said, you need to change this. But she won't admit it. And that's the thing, you know. If she just said, look, I screwed up. It's an embarrassing mistake. I'm going to fix it. Let's move on. The story wouldn't have so many legs.
Absolutely. And speaking of embarrassing, you and I had a pretty good chuckle at this, Terry Cowgill, this viral video clip. That's going around, and you have a Substack column on this, of a very serious and erudite protester at Columbia wondering why they couldn't get food brought in. I chuckled when I saw this, and apparently you did too. And I was wondering, Terry, did Chairman Mao and Fidel Castro say the same thing? I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know. I think certainly in Castro's Cuba, students wouldn't be allowed to occupy a building like that. And if they did, they wouldn't get room service for their food.
Mm-hmm.
But they would probably get great health care because, Cuba's famous for its great health care, they say. But yes, I just thought that this was ridiculous because it really was kind of a caricature that only The Onion could come up with. and she basically said that, if we have meal tickets. So what do they want us to starve and dehydrate to death here?
Well,
of course, it's very easy for her and the others to simply get out of the building, walk to the Diamond Commons and get their food. So this is a parody that practically wrote itself. This column did. So I was happy to do it. But, you know, the thing is about this whole about the protests and I hear cries of police brutality. I really look, I'm old enough. Do remember 1968?
Oh,
my
yeah.
family had just mm-hmm. moved to Chicago.
Wow!
About 2 weeks before the Democratic convention took place.
Wow!
I met a new friend, and we climbed up in a tree and watched the protest. It fortunately was not a violent one.
Yeah.
But I was there in Chicago when it happened. Hundreds of people were injured.
Uh-huh.
One person died. There was police brutality going on in Chicago. Courtesy mostly of Mayor Daley.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, 3 or 4 years later, Kent State, you know, talk about police brutality there. They opened fire on mm-hmm. a bunch of protesters. So the people who are saying that, dousing some of these protesters with pepper spray is police brutality, I don't know. They haven't been around as long as you and I have.
Absolutely. Now to a couple of serious things to wrap up here, both that really do affect people, even though they might not know it. A possible weakening of Connecticut's freedom of information laws, and also there's controversy about the state ethics code as well.
Yeah. Now, so these are two what I call the sort of immutable laws of physics, which is that politicians will always try to weaken freedom of information laws,
mm-hmm.
and they will always try to weaken ethics laws because they're very inconvenient to them. And there is a proposal now, this Freedom of Information Act was famous. It really was a landmark bill when Governor, the first female governor. Now, I'm drawing a blank.
Ella Grasso.
Ella Grasso.
Ella Grasso.
Ella Grasso signed it. And it really was a model that a lot of other states aspired to. But politicians have been whittling away at it ever since 1975 or so when it was signed. And now they want to exempt some more information, such as I found it interesting that they want to exempt information related to academic research.
Hmm.
Now, really, I mean, UConn, which is basically the fourth branch of government, they basically want to exempt information related to academic research that uses taxpayer dollars to perform the research. I'm sorry. And a lot of people are saying, you know, well, you know, they need these exemptions because they might fear for their safety
or whatever. That's ridiculous. Stop.
I know. It's just not convenient for them. But the lobbying thing is very interesting. I mean, Kevin Rennie wrote a really scathing column on
this. I saw that.
Current.
Yeah.
But, there is a longstanding prohibition on lawmakers representing who are lawyers representing clients before state agencies. Now, first of all, I don't think they should be able to represent clients before any state agency because they're state legislators. But apparently they are. And now lawmakers want to exempt two of these prohibited regular authorities, PURA and the Siting Council.
Mm-hmm.
And there really is no reason to do that other than to allow these lawmakers to make more money in their side hustle, which is practicing law. But the ethics laws drive me completely crazy because, you know, I did a column on this for the News Junkie a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Larry Cafiero?
Minority
leader?
I used to speak with Larry on a regular basis. Yes, I know him well.
Yeah, nice guy. I actually like him. But he worked for Brown Rudnick, which was a law firm and lobbying firm. And the law actually allowed the firm to come into the Capitol and lobby Cafiero. Now that struck me as insane. There was a state senator named Mae Flexer,
yes,
a nonprofit.
Uh-huh.
She was allowed, the state office of ethics allowed her to solicit donations to this nonprofit to lobbyists. She could solicit lobbyists for donations to her nonprofit. Joe Arasimowicz, who was the Speaker of the House not too long ago, he worked for AFSCME, one of the biggest, largest public employee unions in the nation, and he was allowed to vote on contracts negotiated by AFSCME. And this is the kind of thing that some politicians and candidates want to stop, like Tom Foley. You remember him? He ran for governor.
Yeah.
Remember when he marched into the Capitol?
Yeah.
And he blasted the whole ethics system, and he proposed reforms that were made criminals out of half the legislature. and he was practically booed out of the Capitol.
Yes, promptly.
No, it's crazy. It gets me absolutely enraged. So if you get me started, I'm going to rant for an hour.
No, that's okay. And going back to the FOI piece here, and you mentioned UConn. Well, you know, look, Terry, you and I both know that, and listen, I know people that teach up at UConn. I know the UConn Health Center does excellent work, and I know people that have had great medical care there. But you and I both know that the UConn Health Center, as great as it is, for it is a money rat hole. And anytime you ask UConn, as far as the school, to, you know, justify what they do with their money or do any sort of an audit, they push back like they're being forced into a foxhole. So, you know, that whole thing with UConn, it doesn't really surprise me at all.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, there's so many things that UConn is embarrassed to pay for. And so they funnel it through the UConn Foundation. It functions as like a slush fund to pay for something that would look ridiculous for UConn to pay for. So they have that. They do have the UConn Foundation for some of these things. But the UConn Foundation is not going to bail out that John Dempsey Hospital, that's for sure.
No. Terry Cowgill, check out his stuff, folks, at the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com and substack.com/, or the actual blog is called Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Terry, good to have you back. We'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.